The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is Maggie Haberman, a White House correspondent for The New York Times and an analyst at CNN. Haberman was born and grew up in New York and worked at The New York Post and Politico before joining The Times in 2015. After covering the election last year, she has been reporting on the Trump administration and is considered to be one of, if not the single most, wired-in reporter in Washington. Maggie Haberman joins me now from our New York studio. Maggie, welcome.
Isaac, thank you for having me.
So I want to know, since you are someone who I think people read your byline, people have some sense about you maybe from Twitter or from the articles you write. It's a crazy time to be living in. It's a crazy time to be covering Washington. Can you just lay out what your day is like as the White House correspondent for The New York Times?
Sure. I liked your crazy time to be living, because that's true for everybody. I'm one of six people on our White House team, and I live in New York. The rest of our team is in D.C. Glenn Thrush, who is my closest collaborator on our team, is a former New Yorker, so there's a certain rhythm to it that's a little easier otherwise might be. But I mean, my day is sort of, if I'm in New York, it's centered around taking children to school in the morning, going to work during the day, and then the day sort of never ends in the Trump era, right? I mean, this is what we saw in the campaign too, is you are watching until late at night when, you know, strange filaments of news start floating around, or when he tweets, or, you know, someone gives a cable interview or so forth and so on, or just, you know, something happens and you get a scoop. When I'm in D.C., it's really just, you know, running from the minute I'm awake until the end of the day. I try to use D.C. to see people who I wouldn't see otherwise. It's a lot of perpetual motion. I don't know of another way to describe it. And I have spent the last 2 years overall, which I expected for the first 18 months of it because it was a campaign, but the last 6 months of it, canceling more plans than I ever imagined I'd have to.
Personal plans, I assume you mean.
Correct.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm wondering is, you come into the office and you start working and you're talking to sources and you're tweeting and you're doing whatever it is journalists do, writing your stories. Can you compare kind of how that's different from previous administrations you've covered or previous campaigns you covered? That is it that people are calling you more? Are you constantly thinking there's some story I need to get? What is it that's driving it? Is it that your editor says, well, you've got to cover this because this happened 12 different times today? What is it?
Sure. It's all of the above, and it depends on the day, right? I mean, sometimes there is something happening that is deadline-driven or government-driven, and we know what it is, and we gravitate toward it. So the Affordable Health Care Act would be an example of that today, right, or yesterday. Other times, it's the president's going to hold a press conference, and, you know, what do we expect him to say? Other times, it's, and this is oftentimes, there is some, you know, staff intrigue going on, and the difference in this White House to other White Houses is it is the leakiest White House I've ever covered, and it's one of the leakiest administrations I've ever covered. I've covered New York City government for years. I covered state government in New York for years, and I've covered other municipalities. This is really unheard of. You know, it's almost as if the staff in the Trump White House uses reporters as a reality testing measure. I think because the perspective from inside the building can feel somewhat distortive sometimes. So you see a lot of people reaching out, and it's obviously not just to us. It's also the Washington Post. It's also to Politico. It's also to, you know, CNN. It's also to other publications. The level of sort of chaos and dysfunction within this West Wing is high. And it's not just who's up, who's down, you know, staff machinations. It is the story of how this president governs and manages, and that's very important. Spent a lot of time on that.
Well, let me ask you, when you say a reality testing mechanism, is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
So you mean that they're, what do you mean by that? That someone inside the White House feels like they have a distorted perspective, and so they call you, or what you
yeah,
mean.
I think that therapists look I think reporters are often
that's an
therapists
interesting slip,
for
Maggie. That's an
people.
Interesting
it was, I'm very tired. I think reporters are often sort of therapists for people working on campaigns. Right, this would not be the first campaign where that happened, although it did. I think it happened on the Clinton side of the equation too. But I do think you have a lot of people inside the White House who feel the need to essentially get a reality check. You know, from your perspective, is this blah, blah, blah? Or, you know, this seems, you know, this weird thing is going on in here. I'll give you a for instance. So I tweeted last Friday that the super PAC supporting President Trump that Mike Pence has been supportive of and one of his former aides works for, two of his former aides work for, was planning a seven-figure ad buy against Dean Heller, the senator from Nevada, who was a no vote on the Affordable Health Care Act. Now, that it has not materialized to seven figures, but it is now at six figures as of, you know, 2:35 today or whatever time this is.
This is Tuesday and, for people. Tuesday, yes.
Right. I tweeted that, and, you know, I got a lot of messages from people inside the White House saying some version of this makes no sense. Why are we doing this? You know, did you get any sense from people you spoke to about what their thinking was? That's what I mean. It is very unusual to have reporters sort of be conduit is the wrong word, but be sort of channelers of various types of information from rival factions inside a government, and that's what you see here.
What is your sense of what the people inside the White House, and this is a generalized question, you can answer it however you like, but what is your sense of what they make of their boss and his leadership style?
I think it depends on who you're seeing, who you're talking to. I think that remember, most of the people in this government have no previous administrative experience before in a White House, right? So they don't really have a huge basis for comparison. Most of them, I would argue, are beginning to see that this is not typical. This is not how a White House normally functions. I think that
well, it's only June 2017. They're finally realizing this. Okay, that's good.
You know, I think that sometimes looking into the abyss can be hard. And so I think that a lot of people, it has taken some time, but I think most of them recognize, you know, for better or worse, right, that this is not a typical White House. Most of them also recognize that Trump seems to both foster and tolerate an astonishing amount of chaos taking place right beneath him. And I think it is anxiety provoking.
Right. It's definitely anxiety provoking. Speaking of anxiety, I was trying to make a smoother transition, but I blew it. Speaking of anxiety, how much anxiety do you have? I don't mean about the country or whatever politics, but I mean, just do you feel constantly anxious with your phone going off? Do you have moments in the day where you try to shut it off, where you tell your kids, I'm not going to look at my phone? Do you turn it off at night? How do you regulate that anxiety?
I never turn it off at night, which is a really bad thing. But I do try to go a couple of hours without looking at it over the weekend, you know, with mixed levels of success. I think that was very hard for the first 3 months or so of the administration. I think at this point, everyone has recognized, you know, you have to take a break or else it's just not going to work. This has not been easy on my kids. This has been hard for them. I think that I'm the daughter of a journalist, so it's not like I don't know how this is on children, and I am trying hard with pretty mixed levels of success to be present. And I think that the Trump administration, plus the fact that we are all connected all the time, makes that very hard.
Trump seems to like you and seeks you out for interviews. Can you talk about first how you met him and what your relationship was like, and then why you think that relationship has continued now despite your reporting?
I actually want to be clear on something that I think is pretty important. I don't think he has sought me out for interviews as president, and I have been pretty clear about that in a piece that Dylan Byers at CNN did about me. I did not participate in it, but I did make very clear to him, because he asked me a question along those lines. You know, he said, can you just answer this? And I said, I can answer that. And that's not true. I want to be very clear that that's not, you know, what you're saying is not quite the way this has worked. I have asked for time when he has spoken to me. So what I don't want is to leave some misimpression about that. I think that in terms of, look, one of his aides, Sam Nunberg, came to me and early on when he was still thinking about running in 2016 and said, Trump is going to declare on June 16th and we want you to break it. And I said, no. And he said, why? And I said, because I did this in 2011 and I'm not going to be Lucy with the football again. You know, and in 2011, Trump had made all these noises about running and he didn't run. And then he decided he wasn't going to run during sweeps week for The Apprentice. And right after that odd how that works. Right after that was that White House Correspondents Association dinner where Obama just, you know, eviscerated him. I think he knows me. I think he knows that I work for the New York Post. I think that he tends to be more familiar with people who are from New York. The fact that I worked at tabloid and so forth and so on. But I don't think that he is seeking me out or anything like that. I also think that you have to remember how incredibly important the New York Times is, right? In his mind, that's a really, really significant thing. He is very, very big on sort of the validation of the New York Times. Real estate developer who came in from Queens into Manhattan, was never taken very seriously by the city's elites, and that's a big thing for him. And so I think that to the extent that you have seen him, you know, prior to winning during the campaign, when his team would seek me out on something, and far more often it was me seeking things out, it's because, you know, the Times holds a singular fascination for him and he wants their approval.
Did you meet him when you were at the Post? How did you get to know him?
I don't remember if it was at the Post or the Daily News. And I didn't know him particularly well when I was at the tabloids. I really got to know him in 2011 when he was doing his sort of pseudo run or his proto run, whatever it was. But he was sort of everywhere, right? I mean, Trump for a tabloid commodity, when I was at the Post and the Daily News, I was at the Post first, then the News, then I went back to the Post. And the common thread on those 14 years is that Donald Trump was sort of omnipresent. The Daily News had a bit of a difficult relationship with him. Pete Hamill, who had been the editor-in-chief for a time in the 90s, had really resisted writing about Donald Trump's and his divorce and stories about him and so forth. And the Post just ate it up. But he was sort of everywhere. It was even then, honestly, I hadn't thought about this until you just asked this question, but the tabloid construct at that point was you either love Trump or hate Trump. And if you love Trump, it was the Post. And if you hated Trump, it was the Daily News. But it's very much what you see him kind of putting on people now.
What do you mean putting on people?
I mean, I think that he's turns everything into kind of an up-down vote on him, right? At literally everything, whether something relates to him or not. He conflates himself with the institutions that he serves and with the people he represents. So he turns everything into a referendum on him in one direction or the other. And I think that there is an omnipresence about his presidency that I don't remember with previous presidents. And I'm 43, so I feel like I can say that.
Right. There's another word for turning everything into a referendum on you, but I guess
you can say that word if you want.
I was thinking solipsism, but
right. I knew which word you meant. Thank
yeah.
you.
Oh, okay. A little mansplaining is what this podcast needs. I
appreciate. Thank you. No, that's good. That's good. We can do that again before the end of the episode.
Okay, good. Well, I won't be able to help it, so it'll definitely happen before the end of the episode. Two-part question. The first is, has he changed in any way since 2011 that you've noticed? I don't mean in terms of age per se. I just mean anything about his personality?
It's a great question. I don't think so. I mean, I think by 2011, he was pretty hardened into what we see now, which is not really able to laugh at himself. Absolutely no problem with fudging facts, which he's always had an issue with. I think that I think he has gotten maybe a little bit more vocal about terrorism since 2011 and about about radical Islam, as he would put it. But I think that that's by dint of running more than anything else. I mean, it's not like the birther lie that he was so eager to, you know, fan in 2011 was unrelated to terrorism or to Muslims. Or being other. But he certainly is more vocal about it. I think he's slightly less careful with what he says now. I don't think there's a huge difference between him from 2011 to now. I think there's a bigger difference between him from 2000, which is when he had flirted with running previously in a pretty public way, to 2011.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you said making fun of himself or being able to laugh at himself. If you watch interviews from 2000 or even up on the Howard Stern show, I would say through 2003, 2004, he really does have an ability to laugh at himself and to kind of look at himself as an ironic figure. And I don't think that's there anymore. And that's interesting. That's how you phrased it.
Yeah, no, I agree with. I mean, look, it's funny because, as you know, one of his favorite phrases about anything in life is, you know, they're laughing at us. This person's laughing at me. This person's laughing at that one. Everyone's laughing at the United States. It's like some very protracted version of the prom scene in Carrie, right? Where it's like everything is all about, are you being laughed at?
Hopefully not ending the same way for the country, but yeah, okay.
I'm not saying they were twin moments. I'm just saying that the singular focus on that has been really, really striking.
When you go into the White House and interview him, what is there some aspect before the tape recorder's on that seems different about him than you think people would get from just reading your interview or watching him being interviewed?
I mean, I think that he's the last Oval Office interview that we did, we ran the transcript, and you know, pretty much every interview we've done with him in the last year, I think since David Sanger and I did this the first foreign policy interview we did with him, I think they've all been pretty clear on who he is, but he is charming in a way that I think doesn't necessarily leap off the page on the transcripts. He can be very funny. He can be very disarming. There was a moment in the interview that Glenn Thresh and I did with him about infrastructure, which is the one where he also opened by defending Bill O'Reilly and saying that Susan Rice should be in jail. But at one point, Gary Cohen, the president's top economic advisor, sneezed and sort of sneezed all over Glenn, who was sitting to my left, and Gary Cohen was sitting to his left and, you know, was sort of flanking one side of the Resolute desk. And the president said, "Oh, watch it. You know, that was a big one. You know, I got to protect my guy." And it was just sort of a funny moment. He has a bunch of those. But, you know, if you read the transcripts of him talking, he talks on tape the same way he talks if you're off the record, which is in this really discursive style. I mean, one of the things that I think that people miss about him, especially with a lot of the stories that get done about palace intrigue, is sometimes when he's asking someone, you know, this is a for instance, I'm not saying this person is in trouble, quote unquote, but, you know, how do you think Sean Spicer is doing? Sometimes he might have in mind that he wants to find someone else. Sometimes it's just the way he talks. Sometimes he'll make a decision and he'll ask repeatedly, you know, was that the right decision? Or I think I made the wrong decision, such as when he chose Mike Pence over the summer and came very close to undoing it later that night, despite aides insisting that wasn't the case. What his aides insisted at the time was, that is just how he talks. That is just how he talks. And sometimes it is just how he talks. And the key is figuring out when he's actually thinking about making a change or not. And very rarely are you going to know until after it's done.
You mentioned palace intrigue stories. And one of the things that I think is interesting is there's been a lot of criticism. I've certainly written that piece making fun of stories about palace intrigue and how the media spends.
You?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
Occasionally. But
This is woman-splaining. I'm just doing it backwards.
Oh, good. No, but I see now you've thrown me for a total loop here. I don't know what to say.
Sorry.
No. I just got to get my rhythm back. So I was going to say that palace intrigue stories, some people don't like them. Some people say they're not, you know, you should be focusing on issues. Do you feel, though, in this White House that palace intrigue stories are a level more important than in previous White Houses?
I absolutely do. I mean, and I'm sorry, I thought I had said that before, so I apologize for not being clear. But yeah, I mean, it's they tell a story that few other things do, especially because, look, there are certain things that are going on in this White House. They are rolling back a lot of regulations, and that was a big campaign promise of his. And for his voters, that is an important promise kept. His detractors do not like it, but it is something he's done. But beyond that, there is not a whole lot of major work coming out of this White House. And so, you know, the staff intrigue stories, quote unquote, really are telling the story of him adjusting.
Well, let me just tell you my own development about this, and then you can tell me if you think I'm right or wrong, which is when the palace intrigue stories were starting during the transition, and there'd be stories, you know, Jared's up, Bannon's down, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And my sense had been, as someone who doesn't know Trump and but reads the news, that, you know, the last person to whisper in his ear is really important. And so the importance of palace intrigue stories is obvious because this is how a policy is going to get made. I guess over the last 6 months, I've changed a little bit. And I sort of think that, yeah, it probably matters somewhat who's whispering in his ear. But at the same time, Trump is going to be Trump no matter who's whispering in his ear. And he can't.
That's very true. Okay. That's very true. Yeah, I mean, but it's not always true. Trump is going to be Trump if Trump feels very strongly about a certain issue. So I'll give you an example. The Paris Accord. Trump was never really going to come, you know, around and keep it, even though I think he might have gotten sort of close, depending on who you're talking to. But I'm not sure that that isn't just people trying to make themselves feel better. This is that he believes it's a bad deal. This is actually an area that he cares about. It's something that he has focused on before. It is in keeping with his kind of nativist instincts that have been consistent, by the way, for 30 years. So nobody was really going to get that. Wasn't, you know, that wasn't. Yes, it was a win for the Bannonite wing of the White House, whatever you want to describe that as. But really, that was Scott Pruitt. And that was the president himself. On a bunch of other things, the president could be swayed. You know, there are also, to your point, though, about like Trump is going to be Trump. I know that, you know, Ivanka and Jared get tons of credit for the LGBT protections that stayed in place, you know, circa Obama. Under the current president, I don't think Trump was ever going to undo those. Trump is not anti-LGBT rights in the way that a lot of Republicans have approached the issue. He's certainly not going to be leading a pride parade. But one of the first things that he said when he came into office was that same-sex marriage decisions is the law of the land and should stay that way. So I wasn't surprised that he did that. And I think that was where he was leaning. Look, he can always be influenced. And if it's an area where he's unfamiliar, then he can be influenced. If it's hiring a staffer, he can be influenced. If it's, you know, what he should think about somebody, if you whisper in his ear something bad that person said about him, that can influence him. But on sort of these broader issues, yes, he has a certain grounding and he sticks with that. I think your impulse is correct.
Just to talk about your career for a minute, you made the journey from Politico to The Times, which is something that now I think a fair amount of people have done. And I was wondering how you think the political coverage and your job changed when you went to The Times versus being at Politico.
You know, when I was at Politico, when I first got there in 2010, I was, among other things, I was pregnant with my third child. I was doing a blog out of New York, and I really was, I mean, you know, Politico tried very hard to get me off of this idea, and I just wouldn't. I really wanted to write about New York, and you could argue that I was ahead of the curve, or you could argue that I was completely resisting change, because, you know, the party has kind of come around back to New York. Or, I mean, the general party of political coverage has been pretty New York-centric over the last couple of years. But I don't think that I was quite ready to be a national reporter, if I'm being honest. And so I focused a lot on New York. And then in 2011, I was assigned to a blog that was co-anchored by Alex Burns, who I barely knew. We had coincidentally gone to the same high school, many years apart. But that really worked, and we, you know, our coverage sort of clicked, and we wrote a a shared blog with a singular voice. And that was a challenge. And I think we did it really well. And I didn't travel a ton, but that was when I did a lot of the Trump stuff in 2011. And then, you know, look, I mean, the Politico coverage was very focused on quicker hits. The Times likes to take a little bit longer, but I think at Politico, you know, you do sort of fewer dutiful day stories. I think at a large institution, you do have to do that. And that's a little more challenging in the Trump era, where the news can change from AM to PM pretty fast.
Right. Well,
you know,
yeah, go on.
Sorry, go ahead. No, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I mean, I was wondering also, given that a lot of Politico people went to the Times, if you think the Times in the 2 years you got there has changed in a...
Oh, I think so. I mean, look, I think that the Times, I think the Times tried First Draft as a standalone subpage. And I think that, you know, subpages weren't really visited that often anymore. But I think First Draft did have a lot of really terrific reporting on it. I was doing, when I first got to the Times, a lot of pretty quick hit stuff. And it found an audience and editors were receptive. But, you know, I mean, I think that I don't think that the nature of the Times' coverage has changed. I think that the nature of politics has changed. And so I think that, you know, some reporters who are used to sort of a more tabloidy environment perhaps is useful, but I don't think that that means that the Times has become different than what it was. I just think the environment has changed. I mean, you know, Glenn Thrush was a magazine writer before he came to the Times, and yet here he is.
At the risk of incurring your wrath, because I know you argue with people about this on Twitter, but I did want to bring it up.
Thanks for that. Great.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a good way
to enter
into the subject.
It's going to be really good. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to know, looking back in hindsight, how do you feel like the media's coverage and the Times in particular's coverage of Hillary Clinton over the campaign was?
I think that I'm not a spokesperson for our coverage of Hillary Clinton. I think that there are areas where we did well, and I think there are areas that we didn't do well. But if you're asking if I think that we focused too heavily on her emails, the answer is no, I do not think so. I think that she was under FBI investigation, despite her campaign claiming that she wasn't, by the way. I don't know. You'd have to compare it to the other time a major party nominee was under active FBI investigation for me to have a sense of whether we blew it out of proportion.
Well, right. I mean, I guess put the Times aside. I mean, I know there was that front page with the, you know, when the Comey letter came out and...
I'm sorry, but you know what? I know I've said this on Twitter too.
No. Say it again. Say it again.
Sure. Why not? The debate is basically whether it should have been two or three stories that day on the front page. The debate is whether the headlines were specific or not. That letter was remarkable. And the idea that it should not have been covered is baffling to me. And I strongly suspect if that letter had been written about any of her rivals and the Times had covered it the way her folks suggest we should have, and it isn't really her folks, it's honestly her supporters mostly, some campaign people, but they would have accused us of burying it. So every media outlet made a lot of mistakes, right? I personally made a lot of mistakes in 2016. But I think that focusing on that day is
no, that's fair. Maybe I should not be focusing on the Times. I mean, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you're picking out the Times, which I really wish you wouldn't do. Number one, and number two, if just because it's not really something I can address here in a fulsome way, and number two, since you're mentioning that one headline, I think that you know the number of times I have had people tweet that headline at me is. Really quite something, but I'm really all ears as to what we should have done that would have been some great solution with a really unusual letter like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my larger complaint personally would be the issue of, you know, the evening newscast spending more time on emails during, I think, 2016 than, they added up all the issues, healthcare, global warming, all these things. And I do think that is a problem, but that's a larger problem with news coverage generally.
Then I wish you had asked that instead of just about the New York Times.
Well, hey, maybe I'll just unedit the whole part.
But that could be your mistake for this podcast.
There'll be more than one. last question, and then I'll let you go. Is there some aspect of, I mean, maybe I don't want to make you blow a scoop, but I mean, Is there some aspect of the Trump administration that you feel like you're more interested in, that you want to read more about, that you want to think about more, that you want to talk to more people about? What interests you intellectually?
That is an excellent question. There are two, and one is I just would like to read more about the regulatory reforms that they're making and or changes that they're making or rollbacks. I think there is a profound impact. I think that there's three areas. That's one. The other is just more sort of it's more of a mood piece, but it's about the empowered cabinet secretaries in a sort of decentralized White House, like we're seeing, right? Especially where a lot of these positions are not filled. And then the other, and this is just because I have kids. I'd like to read a lot more about what Betsy DeVos is doing with education funding.
Those are all interesting areas. Maggie Haberman, thank you for taking time out from your extremely busy schedule to, and that was not a, that was not mocking you, it literally a very busy schedule, to come do this podcast.
I always love talking to you, you know that.
All right, thanks. And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Audrey Dilling, with help today from Mary Wilson. Our theme music was composed by Doug Chase. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to let me know your thoughts, email me at ask@slate.com. That's ask@slate.com. And one more thing. If you're looking for great podcasts from Slate, maybe you think this one doesn't measure up, why don't you check out Trumpcast? The rotating hosts are Jacob Weisberg, Virginia Heffernan, and Jamel Bowie, and they dive deep into all things Trump. Stay up to date on his latest tweets, his scandals, the news about him. Each week from Trumpcast, you will get all this and more. Find it at slate.com/Trumpcast. Wasn't that fun?
That was great. That was great. You're a hoot.